Well, please take out the scriptures, either in the pew rack or the one you brought, and turn to Mark chapter 4, verse 35 and following. And in the midst of all the paraphernalia in your bulletin, there is an outline to show you the Old Testament basis for this text of Isaiah 65. This text is quite appropriate for the Yucatan send-off because it's about the first evangelistic campaign in the gospel. It's interesting. Years ago, when we were under Ray Stedman's leadership, the pastoral staff had the joy of sort of following his coattails and going around the world doing pastors' conferences. And one time we went to Australia. We split up into teams. And I ended up in one of the southern cities named Adelaide. And I fell into a wonderful church staff there. In fact, their initials were PBC, Prospect Baptist Church. And it was a great staff. And I went into the pastor's home. And in the home over the fireplace was a beautiful picture of the city of Adelaide lit up under the night sky. And above it was the caption, "Adelaide for Christ." And I thought, here is a pastor with vision who dreams big things. And then I got to know one of the interns in the church pretty well and stayed at his house. We began to share letters back and forth and Christmas cards. And several years went by and I asked him, how are things going at PBC, Australia? And he said, all the staff had left, burned out, tried to reach a whole city. Got overcommitted, too busy, and burned out. And I think it's so true and all too common that we can have the right vision to reach a nation, a city, a village, a company, a school, your neighborhood, and you can do it the wrong way and end up burned out. Now, we've been seeing in the parables that Jesus would not have his disciples be ignorant of how the kingdom grows. And it's at the point at this in the text now where the lectures are over, and it's time for the tutorial to see how much the disciples have learned and how much they're ready to put into their personal experience. And what follows is the birth of the first Christian missionary, who is sent out on the first citywide evangelistic campaigns recorded in the New Testament. So let's look at it in verse 35. And on that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go over to the other side." And leaving the multitude, they took him along with them, just as he was in the boat, and the other boats were with him. And there arose a fierce gale of wind, and the waves were breaking over the boat, so much that the boat was already filling up. And he himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And being aroused, he rebuked the wind and said to them, "Hush, be still." And the wind died down, and it became perfectly calm. And he said to them, "Why are you so timid? How is it that you have no faith?" And they became very much afraid and said to one another, "Who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?" So here's Jesus. He's just finished his discourse in parables, and he makes a rather bold decision to go to the east side of the lake. Now, that's a very remarkable move because this is predominantly a Gentile area ruled by a very strong presence of idolatry and demons. Even the physical characteristics of those shores, if you've ever been there, appear ominous and threatening and imposing. Bargel Pixner spent 12 years living at that north end of the sea, and he writes in his book, he says, "The steep cliffs of the Hippane, The most northern part of the Decapolis loomed menacingly from afar. The city Hippos lay there like a fortress on the basalt plateau, resembling the head of a noble steed and looking defiantly across to Tiberias, her rival on the other side of the lake. So at first glance, Jesus' choice to go to that side looks a little odd. But as the story unfolds, you sense that you've come to a stage very large. So there's Jesus. He teaches. And he is so exhausted after a day's preaching, he finds his way back to the end of the little boat, finds a cushion, and falls into a deep sleep, oblivious to the currents, the wind, the waves, the water, and the storm. Kind of reminds me of Sunday afternoons when I go home and I'm oblivious to any storms that might accrue. And it doesn't take much imagination to see behind these gale force winds the threatening powers of the underworld, who are threatened that he's arriving, and they try and prevent the prophet from making an appearance on their shore. And their hope was to fill his tiny little boat up with water and drown this rabbi's venture into the depths of the sea with his disciples. Now, the disciples, who are very experienced in the ways of the sea, are anything but asleep. And they spare no effort to save themselves, but are finally overcome by the waves. Their vessel takes on more and more water until they're about at a standstill. And it's then, in exasperation, they turn to their sleeping rabbi at the stern of the boat, and they rouse him out of his dreamlike sleep and berate him for not lending a helping hand. How can he sleep without a care while they are perishing, boat and all? Now, unbeknownst to them, if you look at your sheet, their activity mirrors the poetic images of Psalm 107. And he says, others went out to the sea in ships. They saw the works of the Lord. He spoke and stirred up a tempest, lifted high the waves. They mounted up to the heavens and went down to the depths. It's a great picture from the crest of the wave to the depths. In their peril, their courage melted away and they reeled and staggered like drunken men. They were at their wits' end. So here's Jesus awakened out of his deep sleep, and he immediately takes command of the situation. And with but a word, the gale-forced winds that Mark describes as great now become a great calm. Same word. I imagine it was a most eerie, frightening calm. And at this point, Psalm 107 reads like a script. They cried out to the Lord in their trouble. He stilled the storm to a whisper. The waves of the sea were hushed. They were glad when it grew calm, and he guided them to their desired haven. Wow. Wouldn't you have liked to have been there? What amazes me, after he rebukes the wind, he rebukes them for their timidity and lack of faith. Now, I thought about this and was wondering, was this the faith he had just taught them in the parables? That once a man sows his seed, he sleeps by night, then rises by day to see divine wonders at work. Perhaps for the same words of the parable of sleeping and rising are used here in verse 38. The disciples, rather than sleeping, were like the nervous farmers who roused their master from his sleep to inspect the difficult situation. And when it was over, the fear of the sea was replaced by a greater fear of, who is this prophet? Who is this that even the wind and the sea obey? Who is this that does such things that only the Creator God is said to have done in the Old Testament? Who is this? Who is this that calms the sea? I'm sure such questions pressed in on them with greater force than those tumultuous waves. And I'm sure now that their minds were anything but calm as they now glided upon the glassy sea with no wind to oppose them or aid them. Still more wonders await on the other side of the lake as the confrontation escalates even further. Verses 1 to 9 of chapter 5. And they came to the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gerasenes. And when he had come out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. And he had his dwelling among the tombs. And no one was able to bind him anymore, even with a chain, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains were torn apart by him, and the shackles broken into pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. And constantly, night and day, among the tombs and in the mountains, he was crying out and gashing himself with stones. And seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up and bowed down before him, and crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What do I have to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you, by God, do not torment me." For he had been saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And he was asking him, "What is your name?" And he said to him, "My name is Legion, for we are many." So Jesus gets out of his boat in the country of the Gerasenes. The Gerasene country may be derived from the Hebrew word garash, which comes from the Old Testament Canaanite Girgashites, one of the tribes who were expelled from the land at the time of Joshua. And now Jesus arrives in this hostile territory, and they immediately encounter a man who had his living among the tombs. And Mark's betrayal of this man is lengthy, long, poignant, gripping. Here is a man, nameless, who makes his home in absolute isolation. Cut off from all living, he resides among the dead, and he lives at the total mercy of this evil spirit that possesses him. A spirit so formidable, no shackles of the world were able to bind him. Bind is the key word. And continually tortured and tormented, he cries out endlessly through the night. The cries probably echoing between those cliffs. And his only relief is his self-inflicted wounds. I wonder if this graphic portrayal is not an apt description of what goes on in the silent seclusion of the soul for many in our world who suffer from a destructive oppression of addictions that lead to self-hatred, to self-destructive behavior, and in some extreme cases to suicide. I think this is an amazing picture of what goes on in that kind of soul. Isolation, torment, crying, aloneness. And was this the very reason Jesus came to that side of the lake? I think it is. I think he came for this one person. Just as I'm sure today, there is one person hidden in the congregation to whom this text speaks, to free. Jesus came to bind the strong man, to plunder his goods, to set them free. And I think Jesus came seeking this unnamed man whose society had cast off as the walking dead. So the question is, how will Jesus deal with him? Notice he doesn't address the man, but the evil spirit residing in the man. And he asks the spirit his name. If you know the name, you can control the person. And the answer to the name is what? Legion. Legion. Strange name. But that name evokes strong military overtones. Legion was the technical name for a Roman military company consisting of several thousand troops. This guy is bound. No hope. Now, what follows next in the text is as surprising as it is gripping. Verse 10. And he began to entreat him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now, there was a big herd of swine feeding there on the mountain. And he entreated him, saying, send us into the swine so that we may enter them. And he gave them permission. And coming out, the unclean spirits entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the stink bank into the sea, about 2,000 of them. And they were drowned in the sea. This is the Bay of Pigs. And the herdsmen ran away and reported it to the city and out into the country. So the demons immediately recognize who Jesus is, the Most Holy One of God, and fearing his authority and that the days of oppressing this man are over, they beg Jesus, they entreat him not to send them out of the country. Instead, send us into the swine that we may enter them. Now you may wonder, what in the world are they doing? Why pigs? And why the name Legion? Well, Bargle Pixner in his book says, this may be an allusion to the Roman legions who helped Pompey, who founded this region of the Decapolis. Pompey came from Syria in 63 BC, and he conferred pagan Hellenistic rites on the Decapolis. Decapolis means 10 cities. Because of these legions, the demons insist they have the right to remain in this region, if not in people, at least pigs. Why pigs? Because the Canaanites had sacrificed pigs to demons. And you'll see it there in your text in Isaiah 65. So the special relationship between pigs and demons, between the idol and the demon, becomes understandable. Moreover, the emblem of one of the most famous legions, the Decima Frentanus, was the wild boar. That was the Roman legion's insignia. Now, this scene has other military images, not just the word legion. Ricky Watts, who's a wonderful professor at Regent College, he writes in his commentary that the term send connotes a military command to dispatch. The term herd is clearly inappropriate for pigs. It indicates a band of military recruits. And the verb rush describes troops rushing into battle. So it's very significant, if you put the two together, that Jesus did to the demons, casting them into the sea, exactly what the Jews wanted to do to the Romans, to cast them into the sea, like Moses did Pharaoh in the Exodus. But Jesus, in this text, you see, has redefined the enemy. It is not Rome. It's not the politicians. It's the demon hordes that have bound Israel and the surrounding Gentile areas. That's the real enemy. And that's who he came to set us free from. So in a word, the spirits evacuate the man, rush into the pigs, who in turn are so startled, they rush down those rocky cliffs. You've got to go see this in Israel. It's the greatest scene. Cliffs rising about 500 feet above the sea. Suddenly drop off into oblivion. What a sight. 2,000 pigs flying their wings into the sea. The demons are banished. And get this, with it, the land is cleansed of all semblance of idols and idolatry. Can you imagine what a sign this was to that man to see those pigs go over the edge of the cliff? A sign and permanent seal of his effective cleansing. Now, I think it'd be comparable today to an alcoholic, a severe alcoholic, who is taken to the cliff, and he sees every bottle he'd ever touched, every bar stool he'd ever sat upon, every liquor sign whose neon lights had mesmerized him, and every Bud Light commercial he'd ever seen, put in a heap and cast over the cliff into the sea. And when it was done, not only would he be cleansed of the demon, but there would not be one drinking establishment left in his town. Now that's a miracle. That's what Jesus came to do. Well, this not only made an impression on the man, it also made an impression on the herdsman, whose pigs those were. They're so stunned, they immediately run away, spread the news both far and wide in the city and the country. So now the question is going to come, how will the townspeople respond to this miracle? Verse 14. And the people came to see what had happened. And they came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed sitting down, get this, clothed and in his right mind, the very man who had had the legion. And they became frightened. Then those who had seen it described to them how it had happened to the demon-possessed man. And all about the swine. And just as the demons made a request of Jesus, so now the townspeople make a request of Jesus. Same word. They began to entreat him to leave. And as he was getting into the boat, the man who was demon-possessed, he also makes an entreaty, same word, that he might accompany him. And he did not let him, but he said, go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he's had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him. And everyone marveled. What a story. So the report of the herdsman spreads like wildfire. Everyone comes to see firsthand what had taken place. And they all get to the summit of that cliff. There's the man. Once naked, violent, demon-possessed, with a legion, a Roman legion of demons. Now as quiet as that calm sea. Clothed. Rational. A miracle. And that miracle seizes them in fear. But after they see with their eyes what Jesus has done, they are then told the whole story of the high cost of this cleansing in the ear. To cleanse this one soul cost a territory their idols, 2,000 pigs, and thus their livelihood. And as their materialistic minds ponder the value of the life versus that of the idols, their holy fear gives way to the practical, and they ask Jesus to leave. Isn't that tragic? Remember Ray Stedman was teaching this probably 30 years ago, and he had this wonderful little line. Take your leave, Jesus, and take this friend of thine. You love his soul. But we love swine. What will Jesus do? He obeys. How ironic. He who conquered the storm with a word, who subdues and binds the strong man, who commands a legion of demons at will, when facing resistance of the human heart, he yields. If the human will says, please leave, Jesus condescends and he leaves. No argument, no pleading, no protesting, not even a response recorded. He just leaves. He will not coerce himself on a human heart, because that is a violation of the dignity of being made in the image of God. But as he embarks the boat, the man who had demon possessed, he begins entreating him that he might go along. And now with even more irony, he who grants the request of the demons and the townspeople says no to his new disciple. No, you can't come. Go home. Go home and declare what things the Lord has done for you, how he has mercy upon you. And the man obeyed and went throughout that whole region of the Decapolis, sharing what great things Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. Now, what are the theological and practical implications of this for evangelism? First, let me ask you to see the perspective of these two saints. Jesus crossing through the sea, getting to the other side, throwing a legion of enemies into the scene. What memory in Israel's history does that provoke? What? The Exodus. This is a big event. It evokes those powerful memories of the Exodus where Israel came through the sea by divine protection and then watched the Egyptian armies, chariots, horses, and all be hurled into the depths of the sea, never to rise again. It was such a great moment, Moses wrote the poem, Exodus 15, where he celebrates for the first time in Israel's history a new thing. The Creator God has become a warrior, a man of war, doing battle against Israel's enemies. So they sang a song about it. Now, during Israel's exile, Israel made the same cry and plea. She said, "Where is he who brought them out from the sea and divided the waters? Where is he?" And the answer comes in Isaiah. God is coming. And it will be a new Exodus. And it will end Israel's exile once for all. "Do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. Thus says the Lord, who makes a way through the sea and a path through the mighty waters, who brings forth the chariot and the horse, the army and the mighty man. They lie down together and will not rise again." And now here's Jesus. And he reenacts on the northern shore of sea. Of Galilee, the new Exodus. Magnificent! If they just have eyes to see. But it's more impressive than the old. It's on a grander scale, for it is not Rome who is defeated, but the devil. Isn't that great news? So the implication of this is one, if you're hiding from an addiction, it just takes a word from this Savior to free you and to cleanse you of all your idolatry. And it also, as Christians, should take away our fears of the world and those foreboding places we dare not go. You know, the early Christians were so excited about Jesus' defeat of the devil, they went everywhere. They went headlong into satanic strongholds to deliver the captives, set them free. But the enemy was threatened and threw a lot of darts because he was scared. But they did it, didn't they? I remember when we made an evangelistic tour into enemy territory. And it was into a communist country. And I'll never forget the foreboding sense the whole team felt as they started to leave. One couple was in another airplane and the airplane jet engine blows as it starts down the runway. That'll put a little fear into you. And the rest of us were on another plane as we're going over the States, over to Europe. We see this lightning storm right underneath us. And it was like the forces of darkness, just this foreboding sense of, what are we doing? Where are we going? And then we arrived, and the entire luggage of the team had been confiscated back in Germany and put in a bomb vault for 3 days. And so we couldn't even meet the people we were supposed to meet, and we're stuck in this city we weren't supposed to be in. And this whole sense of foreboding began to increase. And then one of the members of our team was just eating, and she choked, and she started to gag, and she started to choke and couldn't breathe. And one of the guys had to do the Heimlich. And after that happened, we just felt this sense of release. Whoa, where are we? And then God did a great thing through His Word, delivering, setting free. So that's the first thing. Have no fear. You can go anywhere. Don't just get in these holy huddles of Christian ghettos. It's so boring. Get out there on the lake. Be fearless. The second thing I'd ask you is, are you fighting the real enemy? The thing that causes me concern is that after Jesus redefines the enemy for Israel, we continue to fight the wrong enemy. The enemy was not Rome. It was the devil. And the idolatry that had infiltrated Israel, that was the enemy. So I ask today, why do so many Christian ministries in America focus on Washington? Now, I'm all for good government, and good government's very important, and we are to pray for our leaders, and we're to be involved as citizens, and bad government's destructive, so I'm not denying that. But when you raise government to the level of the enemy, you have done a disservice to the new Exodus. They aren't the enemy. Whether or not the government opposes us, or even when it helps us, it can't do much. It can't liberate from idolatry through legislation. It's the power of the gospel that liberates. Whether the government opposes us or helps us. It was no obstacle to Jesus. He just did it. The real enemy today is the idolatry that's infiltrated the church. That's where the real enemy is. So that's the second thing. Make sure you're fighting the real enemy. The third thing this text helps us with is, where can we expect the real point of contention with the world? Where is it? Well, the answer is quite clearly. When Jesus confronted the demons, there was no opposition there. They just evacuated. But with the demons went 2,000 pigs. And when you touched their pigs, then the world was upset. So we learn that when evil is confronted and cleansed, it can have a net result of a great financial cost to the community. And when you touch a community's pocketbook, there is persecution and rejection. So we need to count the cost and remember that just one life made in the image of God is far more valuable than all our economic systems based on idolatry. The value of one life in the image of God is worth everything. So I'm expecting to go to the coast this week and see a bunch of Bay of Pigs as you guys go out. Do your thing. Finally, what do we do when we're rebuffed and we're told to leave? On the surface, this text is very discouraging. Divine miracle. Pigs are cleansed. Idolatry is cleansed. And an entire town, a city, rejects Jesus and tells him to leave. This would not make it on the crusade reports of most crusaders when they come back raising support. But they went to the city and nobody responded. But Jesus, by faith, he doesn't counter with a harder rebuttal. He doesn't counter with more force. He doesn't protest. He doesn't lobby. He leaves. But he looks to that tiny remnant who's as tiny and insignificant as a mustard seed. That's where his faith is. This demonic man is the mustard seed of the previous parable. And that's to whom he invests the kingdom. And he says, go about into those 10 cities and proclaim my name. The Decapolis, by the way, was an amazing area. It was permeated by Greek culture, cosmopolitan, lots of commerce, history, had geographical position. It was home to philosophers, teachers, temples, amphitheaters, arts, sports, literature, and it served as a bridgehead to the empires to the east, just like the Bay Area. And Jesus entrusts the kingdom in this guy, insignificant no-name. And he goes about the whole region. You can almost hear that former demon-possessed man saying, "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I don't know zip about philosophy, literature, sports, but I've come to tell my story." And in Mark 7, Jesus comes back to this area and he reaps the fruit of this man who led people to Christ. And Pixner tells us, in less than 4 centuries, a magnificent cathedral would stand on these heights. The presence of a bishop of Hippos at the very first church councils of Nicaea and Constantinople bear witness of how Christianity conquered heathendom, not by force, but by a mustard seed. And I think, my friends, therein lies the power of the kingdom of God for those who have eyes to see, a kingdom for which you never, ever need to be burned out. Amen.